Yeah, so Czechoslovakia, and you obviously went to other places as well. What led you eventually to, because you left feelings of your own volition, did you, in the end?
Yeah, I'll come on to that. One of the biggest jobs I worked on was a multi-daylight vertical daylight platen press.
Yeah.
For B&SW Wagley.
Right.
Up at Pooling Wharfdale, the other side of Leeds. And I worked on that job with Brian Boucher.
Yeah.
In Acceptance, Frank Bullock,
yeah,
Tony Barton,
yeah,
senior,
yeah,
from down in the fishing shop, and I'm trying to remember the name of the electrician I had with me, and I can't remember.
John Knight?
No, it wasn't John Knight, nor Terry Little.
Logan?
No.
Jim Richards?
No. It'll come back to me. Probably too late for this interview. And I was on that job basically for 18 months.
Wow.
Coming home every other weekend.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But it gave me a lot of knowledge. It was a very satisfying job. And it was one of the jobs that Fieldings could be proud of.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Yeah.
It ran behind time, but that was basically because, with it being a vertical daylight, you couldn't just take the board and turn it over and then run it out on a conveyor belt or something like that. Oh. Like they did with the horizontal ones. And they had a system of overhead trolleys with pneumatic grips.
Yeah.
So that picked up the board when it was cut to length from the guillotine, took it along, indexed to the right slot in the multi-daylight, loaded in, and it held there when it was pressed and cured. Then you take them out one at a time and lower them down onto a bed, and then take them off.
That sounds intriguing, because I can't see. It's an heck of a lot easier if they're horizontal, I would have thought. Why did they build vertical?
It was vertical because of the amount of weight and the what have you, and the amount of water in their particular product. Because
right.
It wasn't like some of the multi-daylights where you ended up with a compound that had semi-set going in.
It was
actually... a waste, I was going to say rag, but it was a waste cloth pulp.
Yeah.
That was floated flat onto a vibrated screen, and that was fed into a because it was continuous.
Was
fed into a guillotine, chopped off at length.
Yeah.
Then they took it in and loaded up on the thing.
Yeah.
And that was a new departure for Fieldings. Nobody had ever done that before.
No,
but
I can imagine
at the end of the day, it worked successfully in there. Yeah. And I ended up going from there to Commercial Plastics in Newcastle.
Yeah.
They were in opposition to Formica. They were quite big at that time. Along with John Little. On another multi-daylight platen press, but this time it was.
Yeah, it was the conventional horizontal. Yeah.
But whilst I was away on these jobs, things were not progressing happily at Fieldings. And they had a round of what they called consolidation, but it ended up with people like Wilf Gardner and a number of others that we had a lot of time for and that did an awful lot for Fieldings being dispensed with.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they brought in a Frenchman named Jack Nodo. You should remember him. But he was brought in to look at the company and make suggestions about how things could be improved and how costs could be reduced. And of course, typical Fieldings, there was always a joke about any situation. And the usual comment was, get no dough from him now.
I remember a situation because I had a guy who sat with me for 6 months. Right at the end of the 6 months, I'm thinking, oh, what's coming?
No.
And he could not find anything to change what we were doing, doing the manuals. No. I mean, what he was paid to what we were paid.
Well, we'd got into the middle of 69 by then. And as much as I loved Fieldings, I mean, Fieldings to me was a terrific place. I loved my time at Fieldings.
Mm.
I loved the people that worked there. It was a real family atmosphere. And I felt that I was part of a family.
Yeah.
And I could see that people mechanism who had driven that for years and years was failing.
Yeah.
It was, I think Jim Fielding had lost interest in it for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And it was just sort of floating along.
Mm.
And when the redundancies came along with, you know, people like Wilf Gardner who put their lives on the line for Fieldings for years, in terms of being away, like I was, I thought, no, it's time to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the end of 1969, I'd gone.
So where did you...
Very reluctantly.
Yeah, where did you go on to? Yeah.
Well, I went, like you,
mm.
I went on to the road selling. But yeah. I was selling an electrical control
right.
grill.
Oh, right.
So I was selling something that was within my knowledge span.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would be dealing with people that I understood what they did and what they needed
yeah.
and what have you. So, and I covered the whole of the West Country in South Wales. From Worcester down to, my biggest customer was English China Clays.
No, down you're here. Joking.
No, John Key House.
My biggest customer as well.
Right.
Seriously, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they were my biggest customer. I used to spend I used to spend quite a bit of time around at their stores and workshop at Nampean.
Yeah.
And part of that organisation was ECC Quarries.
Yes.
And I used to go in and out to their headquarters, engineering headquarters at Essendon.
They've got a place in, they had a place in Salisbury as well. Was that Quarries?
That was outside my patch.
Right.
Exeter was inside my patch.
Yeah.
But I also covered South Wales round as far as Llanelli.
We covered the same patch and probably about the same time, funnily enough. Yeah. ECC was my biggest customer. I was supplying them with big bag discharging equipment, screening equipment was the main thing. Most of the China clay that came out of Cornwall went through American screens made by Sweco. So I was their area agent, because I was self-employed by then. And I also commissioned them, and if they had any breakdowns or anything, I was, you know, on the road very early in the morning to go down and help them sort it.
I've gone on the road at 2 o'clock in the morning
mm.
to go down to John Key House.
Yeah.
I've called in our distributors at Plymouth on the way down by arrangement.
Yeah.
Picked up some equipment
yeah.
to get the production back on the road.
Yeah.
And that's the way I grew the business.
Yeah.
You put yourself out from there.
Yeah.
I also used to go to Lovering and Poaching.
Yes.
And watch Blake Byrne.
Yes.
So,
So you were doing the electrical bits and I was doing a lot of the mechanical bits.
And I stayed on that until the tail end of 1973.
Right.
About October, November of 73, I had a phone call from Roy James.
Yeah.
And he, by that time, was with Indilex.
Oh, right.
At Cheltenham.
Mm.
And he said, I'm looking for a good engineer, specifically with electrical and hydraulic and pneumatic experience. So I said, come on, you're looking for me, are you? And he said, yeah, he said, I'm looking for a plant engineer. He said, can you come along and talk to me about it? So I went along and talked to him about it. I had a look at the setup, and he said, what do you think? And I said, well, to be honest with you, Roy, to put this plant in the shape it should be in is going to take a lot of time and money, if you've got the money. He said, well, our biggest problem at the moment is downtime.
Right.
He said, you know, we're attracting something like 10 to 12% downtime. He said, what do you think it should be? And I said, well, if you could get it 2 to 3%, that would be, you know, you won't better that, because you'll always have breakdowns. A lot of them is finger drum. And he made me an offer, and I said, yeah, well, I'll give it a try.
So were you there for long?
I was there for 19 years.
Wow.
And I worked my way up to works engineer with executive status.
Yeah.
So I was allowed to spend money.
Yeah.
I had a budget, and
yeah,
was allowed to spend within that budget. Basically, do what I'd like to keep the show on the road, and to invest the money wisely to make sure it stayed on the road in the future. But in addition to that, we built a lot of new plants, anodizing plants, and put in another extrusion, number three extrusion press, which is a 1600 ton from Fieldings. 4 years, sorry. About 4 years into my 19 years there, Indalex got bought out by Rio Tinto Zinc.
Oh, right. I didn't realise that.
Which opened up a new ballpark. And I found myself back on the road again, because they also owned a extrusion plant at Bad Salzuflund in Germany. And for whatever reason, they decided they wanted to move this plant from Bad Salzuflund up to Berlin, right alongside Spandau Joe.
Oh, wow.
Right.
The house of its cleaner.
Yeah. So, Roy James kindly volunteered my services, which I was not happy about at all. But I, nevertheless, I did it, and we stripped presses out at this Bad Salzuflund site, and created it all up, moved it up. And I spent a lot of time talking to people like Frank Brook and John Ansley on the phone. And Sid Jenkins. And we got the show back on the road. And you might say, well, why did I spend a lot of time with John Ansley and Frank Bullock? Although I knew how the extrusion presses went together, what I wasn't familiar with was the methods and formula of tightening up the knots on the columns.
So
they made sure the columns didn't break. And we had weathered oil gear pumps on it, which is... Well, I mentioned weathered oil gear when you said big was white, because that's where their depot was. And the guy who dealt with them from the fielding point of view and had all the knowledge of them was John Ansley. So, you know, so, you,
That must have taken you quite some time to move that lot then.
I think it took me 6 months, just under maybe. I do remember that. Roy James had given them a date when he from start to finish, and it'll be up and running by this date.
Yeah.
Now, when I went over there and I talked to the director, and I said, I'm sorry, but I think that's too optimistic. It's going to be nearer this date. And fortunate for me, I hadn't got a crystal ball, but it was the same day we ran the first billet.
Right, brilliant.
So, yeah.
After Indelex, did you move on elsewhere, or is that
What happened with Indelex in 98, they decided, they being RTZ, that they were going to get out of the aluminium industry, because they didn't just own the extrusion companies, they set up companies like Duraflex.
In
Glasgow. So they were into aluminium fabrication. They'd also opened up a gypsum plant down at Sharpness, where they were doing the plaster boards.
Yes, good. I was involved in that one as well.
So the building industry at that time, the recession had started and things were nosediving.
Mm.
So they decided, there's going to be no aluminium windows or doors going to be required. Yeah. There's going to be no plasterboard required and what have you. So they decided to sell the business. Yeah, tell us at that time.
The plasterboard works down in Bristol went to Redland, I think.
Did it?
No, Lafarge. Redland then Lafarge,
Anyway, the first I knew about it was that myself and fellow managers were called up out of the blue and told, sorry, but your job no longer exists and we want you to leave site now. And what we subsequently realised was that they were going to sell the business, and to make it look more attractive, they took out a whole tier of management, because they found out we knew some of the sister companies. I mean, there was an aluminium extrusion plant up in Cheshire, just trying to think of the name of the place, but that's irrelevant. Spoke to them on the phone, and the same thing had happened there.
Then
we had phone calls from the Aluminium Federation, because I happened to be a member of the Aluminium Federation Safety Committee at that time. Phone calls from a couple of people there saying, what's going on? You know, we've had calls from various companies saying, sorry, I won't be able to attend your meetings anymore. And I said, I'm sorry, I was about to do the same as well. I'm sorry, and at that point I realised that, they were cutting.
Getting out.
They're making their sale look more attractive. So